All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your hosts for today's program, Dale Thronberry and Bob Gould.
And good afternoon, America, and welcome to Veterans Radio. Here we are on the 15th anniversary of 9/11, and we're going to be talking about that today on our program. Joining me in the studio to present our information to you today is my partner, Bob Gould. Bob, good afternoon.
Hello, everybody.
What a pleasure it is to have you here. It's been kind of interesting to be here in the studio at the same time.
Even without the AC.
Yes, don't worry about the AC. We shall survive. But it has been, as I mentioned, 15 years since 9/11. And so as I mentioned earlier, we're going to talk a little bit about our own experiences, what our own memories are of that. And then we've got a couple of guests that are going to be talking about that as well. And we want you to get in on the conversation. So if you've got a comment about where you were or how 9/11 has affected your life, or maybe you joined the service, or maybe, unfortunately, you might have lost somebody in the Twin Towers or in the Pentagon or out in Pennsylvania, please give us a call here locally at 734-822-1600. 734-822-1600.
That's easy to remember.
I think so, because we are coming to you from WAAM.
At 1600.
At 1600 in beautiful Ann Arbor, Michigan today, where the temperature is finally in the 70s. Yay. So, Bob, do we want to make an announcements first?
I got one right now. Vets returning home. Who is Vets returning home? Well, Vets returning home, their mission of helping veterans in crisis reclaim their independence. Boy, I'd like that a lot. They provide a safe, alcohol, drug-free program, support veterans who have come into a little bit of crisis. They give them meals, job training, counseling, addiction intervention. That's Vets Returning Home. Well, how can you help out? Aha.
How can we help?
Here's how you can do it. Vets Returning Home is going to have a country concert. It's part of a country concert series. The first one is going to be September 15th. That's in 2 weeks.
No, it's this Thursday.
Oh, my goodness. We're moving along, man, getting into the fall. It's going to be at the Raleigh House in Warren, Michigan. Raleigh House in Warren, Michigan. It's a concert. The concert, it's a country concert. So the country stars is Joey V. Oh, he's got a lot of hits. And Ray
I'm sure
Scott.
He does.
Well, I wonder if Ray Scott is a relative of Jack Scott, who used to sing country, right? But that's going to be at the Raleigh House in Warren, Michigan. Doors open at 6:30, concerts at 7. That's September 15th. So, how can you find out more information? Well, you're going to want to go to Vets Returning Home. Vets Returning Home, and that'll give you all the information, okay? So, that's a good one.
Okay. What I've got is I want to remind people that this is Suicide Prevention Month across the country. And so we wanted to make sure that people are aware of the suicide hotline. That's a veterans crisis hotline.
I think it's Vietnam vets. It's one a day, 10 a day.
Well, it's 22 a day. 22 veterans a day have been committing suicide. And in fact, we were at a presentation, both of us were at a presentation a couple of weeks ago where suicide is not the answer. And so we're going to be talking about that actually next week on Veterans Radio when we're talking about different types of safety nets that are out there to help our veterans. Because even though the numbers, there was a statistic that came out, the VA said that, it's not 22, it's 20.
Yeah,
well,
right.
You know, that's still 20 more people a day than necessary as far as we're concerned. And so we want to make sure that we get this hotline out to you. So it's a Veterans Crisis Line. It's 1-800-273-8255. Press 1. And there's somebody there live, I guarantee it. So if anybody out there is having any problems today and you're not feeling like you're going to make it through the day, call this Veterans Crisis Line, 1-800-273-8255. Press 1.
And we're going to give that throughout the program.
We are going to be giving that throughout the program. Yeah, this suicide prevention thing is something that's very, very important. And I was talking to a good friend of ours here on Veterans Radio from Veterans Refuge, and that's Andrew Turner, who is an Iraq veteran. And they've been putting out, last 2 years, they put out 630 crosses, I think it was, 22 crosses a day they put out in a field locally in the Ann Arbor area. And they didn't do it this year because we couldn't get a location where enough people would see it to draw attention to it. And so we want to make sure that our audience out there is aware of this. So if you have a veteran in your family or you know of a veteran that you think is in crisis, again, give them that number. It's a Veterans Crisis Line, 1-800-273-8255, and press the number 1. It's a live person there. They'll be able to help you right away. The other thing is that at the newest VA facilities in Ann Arbor, I know this is true, they have a psychiatrist on duty in the emergency room, so you can go there directly. And somebody will be there to help you right away.
Absolutely.
So don't mess around with your life, folks. You only get one. And we want to make sure that it's a long and healthy
and
one.
You know, and sometimes a few days after you've had the crisis and you've had an intervention and it's all been brought down, you really start to think about that.
What was I thinking?
What was I doing, man?
Right, because you've got a lot of people out there that depend on you, whether it's emotionally or financially. They need you as much as you need them. So think twice before you do anything too drastic. Check out that Veterans Crisis
Line. Come to your VA.
That's right. And there's many other organizations out there now that are coming. I mean, they're just multiplying because this is such an important issue that we have to make sure. We're talking to somebody this afternoon at the VVA 310 Pig Roast fundraiser for the local Vietnam Veterans of America. And there are programs all over the place. All these veterans organizations are now concentrating their efforts on preventing these suicides. So no excuses, folks. Suicide is not the answer. We've got to help you survive.
We got your back, baby.
And we did before, and we're going to continue doing that. And we have one last event that's coming up. I'd be remiss if I didn't cover it. And it's the 7th Annual Veterans Summit. That is sponsored by the Canton Community Foundation and Legal Help for Veterans, our friends, on September 20th. That is next Friday? Yeah, next Saturday.
12 days. No,
it's
9
Friday.
Days.
We don't
9
do this. This higher math is killing me. Anyway, next Friday, I believe it is, in Westland. You can learn more about health care, business, disability benefits. Remember, Legal Help for Veterans. These are the guys, if you get turned down by the VA, you go to Legal Help, and they'll get it through for you one way or the other. You deserve these benefits. Don't sit back and say, I don't need them. Somebody else can use them more than I can. Get you more treatment.
And you know what's cool about that? That's all done ahead of time, and there's no upfront money.
Right.
Everything is settled when your claim, if it does, gets settled, which
is
really cool, folks.
And the VA
folks.
Pays for it.
Now that's another thing that where your government is there helping you, your VA helping you. Got it? VA.
Right. Anyway,
how about that?
So go to the 7th Annual Veterans Summit at Canton Community Foundation on September 20th in Westland. You can learn more about healthcare, business, disability events at this free event. For more information, go to www.cantonfoundation.org or you can call 734-495-1200. 734-495-1200. So, segue. What do we got now?
You want to do the statue real quick.
Oh, okay. Okay. You can do the statue.
Folks, those of you that live within the sound of our voice, no. But if you are close to southeastern Michigan, you got to see this. The Kiss. By the way, she, the woman that was in the Kiss, Dale, you said she just passed on.
Yes, it was in the paper this morning. I think she passed away yesterday.
Wow. Well, goodness.
Anyway, while you're talking, I'll look.
So the statue is at 13 Mile and Woodward. It's 25 feet high. It's spectacular. Boy, when you come up on it, they painted it in bright automotive colors. So it just jumps out. It's 25 feet high. It was cast in bronze. Pardon me. And go see this. 13 Mile and Woodward is going to be there for the next couple months. But what's coming up Thursday, October the 13th, you're going to want to go to the Royal Oak Farmers Market, and it's going to be a salute to veterans and part of the fundraiser for the Plymouth Veterans Memorial that's being put together. Russell Levine was on our program last week and talked about that. We'll have him back. So, again, Thursday, October 13th, you want to mark that on your calendar. Come to the Royal Oak Farmers Market in Royal Oak, Michigan, and you're going to want to be a part of that. All right, if you want any more information, go to... The light's not... Here you go. You can probably read.
Well, do I have to read this? Holy mackerel. Michigan WW2Memorial.org. Michigan WW2Memorial.org.
There you go.
That's small print.
I know.
Okay. We're not going to go to a break right this second because we wanted to talk a little bit about where we were on 9/11, 2001. And I don't know. Let me start. I was at one of those proverbial meetings that everybody has all the time on September 1st, 2001, up in Grand Rapids. And it was one of these, being in the insurance industry, you know, new product, all these other things. And somebody came into the meeting at 8:46 and said, somebody flew into one of the, you know, the World Center towers. And, you know, in about a half hour later, somebody flew into another one. And everything stopped. And you know, the meeting ended and we just went home. Everybody came home to find out what was going on. It was so terrible to think that anything
shock.
Like this had happened. I mean, it was shock.
Shock
had,
and awe.
I mean, it was our. I mean, it was.
And
our,
it was awe too.
Yeah, it was our generation's Pearl Harbor type of thing. How dare somebody do this? And I, you know, many of us had the first reaction was revenge and go get these people and so on and so forth. And then, you know, things happened. But the whole country shut down. That was what was so amazing to me, how things shut down.
Well, the first thing that I got, I was feeding the cats and having a cup of coffee when I got a call about, it was about 8:45, 8:50. Yeah. And a friend of mine said a plane went into a building in New York. Well, right away I thought of the Empire State Building. Remember that when a B-25? Flew into the Empire State. Well, I thought about that, and I said, what size is the plane? Was it a small plane? And he says, I don't know. Turn it on. And, of course, from that point on, it was shock and awe. And what I remember the most is right around 2, 3 o'clock in the afternoon when all the planes were now grounded and how quiet it was. It was eerie, so quiet. I mean, everything was standstill.
And everybody was afraid because they couldn't imagine what was going on.
I couldn't watch it. After the second tower, I couldn't watch it.
Well, in the paper this morning, they were talking about how they evacuated the Rensen in downtown Detroit because they didn't know. They evacuated tall buildings in Los Angeles and Chicago and all these other things because they didn't know, you know, what was going to happen next. You know, we've got somebody on the line that I wanted to kind of bring in and talk to. This is a local friend of ours. She is a retired colonel from the United States Army Reserve, and that is Colonel Christine Cook. Christine, welcome back to Veterans Radio.
Hi, how are you?
We're doing well, Christine. It's good to hear from you again.
Thank you.
So what were you up to on 9/11/2001?
Well, I had a second grade child and a child who was in daycare, and so I had already gotten my daughter off to school, and I was in the car about to take my second child to daycare when my husband ran out the front door saying some planes hit the World Trade Center, and like Bob, I was sitting there going, well, there was that thing with the Empire State Building. Was it just a small plane? And he goes, no, they were jets. And by the time he had found out about it, the second plane had actually already gone into the second building. So that was one of those things where I didn't want my son to be hearing what was going on when he was only about three. Mm-hmm. So I went over to drop him off at daycare and then try to figure out what was going on. And the daycare provider was just looking like she was in shock. And I said, do you have this on? Because I don't want my own child to be watching it when he's so young. And she said, no, but I have, you know, I have the radio on and I'm listening to the radio. So after that, I mean, the whole day was just sort of, it felt completely unreal. I couldn't think of anything to do because it was being, at the time I was a lieutenant colonel, and I had, I was a lieutenant colonel, and I had a battalion command at the time, and it was one of those things where I just sat there and said, there is no doubt that I'm going to be deployed because of this. You know, it wasn't a matter of if anymore, it was a matter of when. And I was in the National Guard at the time, you know, so I just I spent the entire afternoon just sort of thinking, I'm going to war.
Colonel Cook, this is Bob Gould.
Right.
Hello. Were you put on alert?
I was not put on alert immediately. I was in a personnel unit, so they didn't really think of alerting personnelists first. The first people who were alerted in the state at the time were MPs, military policemen, who were about to go work at the airports. And one of the units in Michigan was the unit that that guarded the Capitol in the first several months after, not state capital, the federal capital, during the first couple of months after September 11th.
And when did you deploy?
I deployed in 2003 after the first part of Operation Iraqi Freedom had, you know, they had ostensibly won the war and we were trying to establish the peace. And so that was when we replaced the whole group that had been sent over to Iraq.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. And then this will be a quick plug. You wrote a little book about your adventures there.
Right. I was living on Tatooine, a.k.a. Kuwait, because I ended up staying the entire year in Kuwait, but my soldiers were all over the entire area.
Well, thank you, Christine, for giving us a call, and we'll be getting together with you to solve the world's problems pretty soon.
Oh, excellent.
Okay.
I always like doing that.
All right. Thank you. Thanks.
Take care.
All right. Bye-bye. That was Colonel Christine Cook of the Michigan National Guard at the time, and what she ended up doing with two small children, as she said, she deployed 2 years later to Kuwait, and we've had her on a program a number of times talking about what it was like to deploy, not just as a woman, but as a mom, which was much different, and so you have to look in our archives for that. But if you have a story of where you were and how it affected your life, please give us a call here at Veterans Radio, 734-822-1600. Right now, I want to get to an eyewitness of the 9/11 attack, and that is our good friend from the Military Writers Society and a well-known author in his own right, and that is Dwight John Zimmerman. Dwight, welcome back to Veterans Radio.
Dale, thank you for having me on here on such a special day in our history.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I want to thank you for taking the time of talking with us. And, you know, as we can see, the time is already flying by. But
yes.
I know.
Oh,
as you know.
Well, there's so much to talk about. Yeah. And, yes, I was a witness to it and what happened. And I have to say it's saddest day of my life.
Did you have to walk? Hi, Dwight. Bob Gould here.
Yeah.
Did you have to walk across to Jersey? And were you covered in dust?
No. Okay. very briefly, I live in Brooklyn, New York, the borough of Brooklyn, and it wound up being downwind of the World Trade Center. I was an editor at a publishing company at the time. So, in my commute, I was the first to arrive at the office, and the phone was ringing when I went in, answered the phone, and it was the mother of one of our staffers, and she was really concerned about her daughter. And I said, well, what's going on? And she said, hadn't you heard? I said, no. And she said, a plane crashed into the World Trade Center. And I looked up. My office had a view of the World Trade Center. I was in... our office was in the mid-20s, and I had a direct line to the World Trade Center. So I looked up, looked through the window, and I saw this gigantic black hole, near the top of, the tower. And we just went, well, oh, Lord. well, I was a little bit more pained in that.
You actually saw this, right?
I saw, I saw this. Yeah, I didn't see the first impact. I saw the aftermath. Okay, so then people are starting, you know, to come in, and, well, at that point, I'm turning on the radios, staffers had, the radios, and it is chaos. You know, reporters are just, giving it, whatever they know, which, of course, at that point is really nothing. They're just observing. They're just saying, a plane crashed in, blah, 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 blah. And one of our editors who lived in Jersey called me up, called the office I answered, and she's saying, the trains are shut down, what's going on here? And as I was explaining to her, that apparently, from what we know, a plane crashed into one of the World Trade Center towers, because the World Trade Center was a junction for a wide variety of light rail and subway system lines.
Right.
So, so for safety concerns, of course, they shut that down. And then as I'm talking to her, that's when the second plane hit. And that came in from the south side. And suddenly I'm seeing this gigantic fireball explode.
And you witnessed this, Dwight?
I witnessed this, and I just went, Dinah, I don't think that you should come to the office today.
Right. And you were, how long before they had you evacuate, or did you evacuate?
Well, we're all stunned.
Sure.
We're getting the news reports over the radio and everything, and quite frankly, for quite a while, we didn't know what to do. We couldn't, obviously, we're not at the emotional, condition to work.
Right.
And we're just saying, well, what do we do? Do we go home? Do we this? Do we that? And we're looking, we're fixated. We're staring at this, and we're seeing these little objects falling from the maw up there. It was only later, after we got home and read the paper and everything, we were watching people leap to their death.
This is a tough story for you to tell 15 years later, isn't it?
As I'm talking about it, one of the first things that I did once I realized what was going on, I'm from North Dakota. My mother, I called and left a message on my mother's machine, because I knew that she would be really worried. And I said, I'm not near there. My wife, and basically the good news was all of us, our family members were well away from the World Trade Center. We did have friends who were there. And unfortunately, yes, I know people who did die. In that, but it was a really good thing that I made that call, because shortly thereafter, all the phone lines went down. So at least I was able to comfort my mother and saying, all of us are fine. we're okay. My wife teaches at a school in Brooklyn Heights, private school. And some of the students there, attended that school as well. Some of his classmates were, they lived in Manhattan. Well, when the subway system was shut down, so we took in, I think it's three of our son's classmates.
Did you, when you went home that day, Dwight, did you have to, I'm assuming you had to walk?
Actually, what happened was Mayor Giuliani said the trains are all outgoing.
Okay.
So for this one brief period, the whole system was working. It was, you know, he said, state of emergency, everyone go home.
Okay.
And this is where he rose to the occasion. He was a true leader mm-hmm. on that day. And everyone got on the subway or the bus and everything. And I have to say, that subway ride home, it was quiet.
I can only imagine.
Yeah, and you didn't hear, because normally, there'd be the, conversations or blah, 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 blah. No. Everyone was just stone cold quiet.
Yeah.
And when I got home, our house happened to be in,
you mentioned earlier that you were downwind from the Trade Center. So was your house covered in dust?
We had dust, pieces of paper. I took the happiest, person there was our dog. She saw me and she's going, "Oh, that master's home." and we're right beside, we live right beside a park. So I took her into the park and I'm seeing all these pieces of paper, in there. And it didn't register at first.
Mm.
And then I went, "Oh." Yeah, and I started picking things up. And envelopes. And I'm seeing World Trade Center. We were downwind. I wound up picking up a wide variety of sheets of paper and documents, including a whole contract, no less, that had blown up and then carried on by the wind.
Uh-huh. Dwight, I have to wrap this up because I got to go to a break.
Yeah.
But I want to thank you for sharing this story because I know it was very difficult for you to relive it. And I'm sure it's very, very difficult for anybody who was in the area of New York City or Washington or Shanksville, Pennsylvania, to relive these days again today. But thank you very much for sharing the story with us.
Well, thank you for asking me to be on your program. Yes, it's a very vivid memory, and it's very emotionally wrenching, but yes, I am happy to share this with people to just let them know what happened.
Thank you very much, Dwight. We'll talk to you again soon, my friend.
Thank you.
Thanks, yes. Dwight. All right, that was Dwight Zimmerman, who was lived in Brooklyn and on the day of 9/11 was in his office looking down on the World Trade Centers and saw the second plane hit the building. I can't imagine what that must have looked like. Just, we've seen all the news pictures and everything, but in person, it's definitely going to have effect on you. I need to take a real quick break here to gather our own emotions here. So we're going to take a break for about a minute. And then we'll be right back with our next guest, which is Dr. Frank Richter, who's going to be talking to us about the history of the Middle East a little bit and what's going to happen in the future. You're listening to Veterans Radio. Back on Veterans Radio, and we're talking about 9/11/2001, the 15th anniversary. Again, I want to remind you the Veterans Crisis Line here. If you know of anybody that is contemplating suicide or is really depressed. This is someplace they need to go for help. It's a Veterans Crisis Line. It's 1-800-273-8255. Press the number 1. There's a live person there that will help you out. Yes, sir, Bob.
Yeah, well, I just wanted to add my own other little story, little anecdote. My son was with one of the investment companies, I don't know which one, the one that lost quite a few people, and they sent him down to buy bagels.
Good day to be a gopher on that day.
And his wife went home, and he was sent down by the office crew to, it was his turn, and that's where he was. And he lived with that, and he died with that, too. My mm-hmm. son did, I think, eventually, that being a survivor, mm-hmm. besides his physical ailments that he had. So, yeah, he survived, but what a thought, and a lot of his friends were lost. Yeah, man.
We all know, you know, we've all lost people.
We've all.
To lose that many people
in
a short period of time. And, you know, it's like one of those, you know, they're there, then they're gone. And in a lot of cases, there was a story on the news this morning that they're still trying to identify some of the people that were missing on that day. And, you know, the families can't even get closure that they need. You know, they can't even bury anything because they don't have anything yet.
Watching those people jump off the buildings, I had to turn it off at that point. I just could not deal. And that was before the collapse, of course.
Yeah. Well, you can just imagine.
I just could not deal with that.
And you can imagine what Dwight was, Dwight realized what he was seeing, you know, the dots that were coming off of the building at the time. He's going to have a tough day today himself, I'm sure. If you want to get in on the conversation, please give us a call here on Veterans Radio. The number is 734-822-1600. You can follow us on Facebook. You can go to veteransradio.net, and you can see our archives. There's a lot of programming there about 9/11, a lot of programs about various treatments for post-traumatic stress, and a lot of other things that I think you'll find very interesting. We're also podcasting stories that don't quite make it to the air sometimes here on Veterans Radio, and there's a lot of good things there. So go to veteransradio.net. I think you'll like that. Joining me on the line right now is actually an older friend of ours from Veterans Radio. It's Dr. Frank Richter. He was on our program back in 2005 talking about a similar issue. So it's going to be fairly comfortable, I hope, for him. He is a national security consultant and political writer, a lifelong Detroiter. He holds a PhD in political science, took his graduate training at the University of Michigan, and taught at Wayne State University. He's written articles in the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Detroit News, Detroit Free Press, political writer and advisor to Ross Perot. After 9/11, Dr. Richter lectured nationwide in dozens of cities on international terrorism. And I think we're very fortunate to have him back on our program. So, Dr. Richter, welcome back to Veterans Radio.
Thank you, Dale.
Thank you for agreeing to come on the program. What I wanted to look at today, not just where you might have been on 9/11, but I was listening to the other show that we did in 2005, and you gave a very concise history of the Middle East. And I wondered if you'd be willing to repeat that a little bit, about how so much anger has erupted out of the Middle East.
Well, sure. Actually, what's going on with Al-Qaeda and a lot of the Islamic radicals dates back, if you want to go back to 1799 when Napoleon invaded Egypt. I won't go through all the things that happened since then, but they see this kind of that is a radical Islamist in the Middle East, as kind of a colonial struggle. First it was against the Europeans. Now they think the Americans are the cultural dominators of the world. And so it's against the United States, who they see is propping up Israel and propping up Saudi Arabia, because the government of Saudi Arabia is anathema to the Arab radicals. They absolutely hate it as much as they hate the United States or Iran. They want to get rid of it. And so the anger has built up as a colonialist, post-colonial struggle as well, and really has very little to do with Islam. I mean, in terms of the motivation, they use that, they hijack the religion to get the attention, to get the recruits. But it's a lot more than some kind of religious struggle between, say, Christianity and Islam.
Well, you mentioned in our other program that, you know, the whole idea of when Islam spread across northern Africa and little bits of Europe up into Spain and so forth, that they were very tolerant of other religions.
Yes, the first, well, Muhammad died, I think, in, I think it was 632, and for the next 100 years, till 732, the Arabs swept out of the, and Muslims swept out of the Arabian Peninsula, went through North Africa, up through Spain, into southern France, conquered about a third of France, and were defeated in 732. But once they did that, and they held Spain and North Africa, for centuries, they were extremely tolerant to the Christians among them and the Jews among them. And in order to live in that area, you just had to pay a tax as a Christian or Jew. But the tax was not at all dissimilar to what Muslims paid for being a Muslim, kind of a tithe in the community. And they didn't have persecutions and pogroms like they did in the Christian continent in Christendom against the Jews. It was very tolerant. And it had been that way, actually, recently, until the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948.
Okay, let's jump forward to then to the end of World War II. This is where I want to go. The end of World War II, when France and England decided they wanted to kind of, or actually probably happened in World War I, but they wanted to divide up the Middle East. It wasn't about oil. This is something that I picked up in our other conversation. It was about controlling of the trade routes, correct?
Yes. At the end of World War One, the League of Nations and the British and French drew up boundaries in the Middle East. It was the British and French drew the boundaries, and the League of Nations kind of said, "We're going to give you mandates to you can control these territories." And it's about the trade routes, and they had oil had already been discovered and was in wide use, so it had something to do with it. But they completely ignored ethnic groups within the countries, and countries like Syria and Iraq, for example, have Sunni and Shia Muslims on both sides and different ethnicities, and they completely ignored those. And that was the same thing happened in Africa, which is one of the reasons the British and French did that, other colonial powers, and they ignore the tribal differences in the countries, and that's the reason that in the Middle East and Africa you have a lot of violence today, because they have completely different ethnic and religious groups fighting one another.
And it just continues to seem to go on and on. And then now we jump forward again to 2001, and Al-Qaeda engineers the terrorist attack on the World Trade Centers, and we go back and we go after the terrorists in Afghanistan and in Iraq. What happened as a result of that? What this led, I guess the question I'm going to, this led to the rise of ISIS and ISIL or whatever they want to call it.
Well, yes, the American invasions of Iraq and also the American intervention in Afghanistan to overthrow the Taliban and work with other Afghans, by the way. They were working with the Northern Alliance, which is a good portion of Afghanistan. So I wouldn't call the American intervention in Afghanistan an invasion. We were working with people who wanted to overthrow the Taliban. But that drew like a magnet, like moths to flame, the jihadists and people who had previously fought against the Russians in Afghanistan. Now the Islamists who saw Islam in a political context wanted to fight the Americans in both Afghanistan and Iraq. And as a result, we found out what the Russians found out, and that is there's no military solution to what's going on in the area. We were a lot more successful than they were militarily, but we found out that it's really a lot more than military victories, which is going to end the scourge, which is going to take several decades, honestly, to end.
Well, absolutely, because you know we can get into the military arguments about this, because you're never going to win in a guerrilla war. You know, like that. I mean, we learned that in Vietnam. We've seen it again in Iraq, and we've seen it again in Afghanistan. You can't wipe out an entire country and expect, you know, peace the way that it's going right now. Where do you see our policy, I guess you could say, as we move into the future?
President Obama has made a decision to be cautious in foreign policies and to pivot to the Pacific area. To he believes the future of America lies in the Pacific Ocean, and he's made a conscious decision, along with a lot of other Americans who agree with it, to get out of the Middle East militarily and let the people in military, our allies in the Middle East, the Arab allies especially, deal with the problem themselves with our help, but not with our ground troops. So I think you can see a lot more of that. But even the way they deal with it, it's going to have to be dealt with. It's really a political religious struggle within Islam itself and the Arab countries and a lot of other countries near India and Pakistan. India is 1/7 Muslim, for example. People don't realize that. It's not only Hindu. They have to struggle with political Islam against ordinary moderate Islam, which is, you know, 10, 20 times more people adhere to that than to the Islamist point of view. The Islamist point of view is really a fraction of a percent point of view in terms of violence. There's a lot of conservative Muslims in the world, but they don't, even the conservative ones, by and large, don't subscribe to the violence which is going on within their own societies or toward Europe or the United States.
Is this mostly just because they don't like our culture, or they feel like we've forced our own our cultural values and everything upon them, and they just want us to get out?
It's not that they don't like our culture. They line up at our embassies all throughout the Middle East to come over here. They don't like our culture or any culture, if it were the Chinese or Japanese culture coming and putting money into the Middle East and propping up the governments in the Middle East, they wouldn't like that either. It's not the culture that they object to. It's the fact that other people are coming in and imposing a different cultural perspective and propping up their governments, which they, in many cases, don't think are responsive to their needs. That's the crux of the issue.
Well, how you doing, Frank? Bob Gould here.
Hi, Bob.
Hi. I think the Russians kind of just bypassed that. Wouldn't you say now that the Russians are looking to be a partner, surrogate government there, right there in the Middle East, and they're starting with Syria? Isn't that correct?
The Russians don't have any interest in exporting their culture, or, of course, they're not communists anymore, but they want to play a role on the world stage. And once the Iranian nuclear deal was completed, both the Russians and the Iranians knew they could cause more trouble. That's a bad phrase, but in Syria, do what they wanted. And I think both countries were waiting for, this is just my opinion, but when the Iran deal was signed, the Russians and Iranians expected the United States probably to come in air power and establish no-fly zones and maybe take out the airfields of Assad if he violated the chemical weapons agreement they made 2 or 3 years ago. And they thought the United States was going to come in militarily and do a lot more from the air. And the Russians decided to preempt. Putin decided to preempt and make it a fait accompli, which is exactly what he did. That's my opinion. That's not the opinion of other people, but I believe it's something worth people ought to be looking at.
What do you see in about 2 minutes, Frank? what do you see occurring in the next 5 years as far as the Middle East or the exporting of this terrorism?
It will continue because of social media. You'll get a lot more lone wolves. I hate to refer to the attacks as pimpricks, because in some cases you get, you know, 50 people [S2] Right. [S1] and 80 people run over by trucks in France. But they, in the United States, since 9/11, there have been something like 94 people killed in the United States by Islamic terrorism. And in that time, I don't know, we probably have probably a few hundred killed by, I guess you'd call it domestic and right-wing terrorism. We talk about, there are only maybe 100, 300,000 Islamic militants in the whole world out of 1.4 billion. It's only a matter of time before they get more credence in the world. If we go over there and we put troops back in there, that's going to be the worst possible thing to do. The way to get rid of the problem domestically in this country, fewer, is to for Americans to look at Muslims in their own country, realize they make a contribution. They're the translators that go in with the Marines and with the Army, and they're good, and they turn in a lot of the people that are a few people, bad apples, in their community. That's how we catch so many of the people before they can do anything in this country. And the radicals who have struck us oftentimes think they're being discriminated in American society by their co-workers. In San Bernardino, you saw a man kill 20-some of his co-workers. We have to be more tolerant of one another.
Okay. Thank you very much. Dr. Frank Richter, our resident expert on the Middle East. And Dr. Richter, we'd like to have you back on again in the next couple of weeks to talk more about that.
Thank you, Dale.
Thank you very much for being on. We're going to take a real fast break, and then we're going to be coming back with our final segment on Veterans Radio. And we'll be right back after this. And we're back on Veterans Radio on our last segment, and we've just been playing some music off of a CD from 9/11 of all of the entertainers that had put it all together. But joining me right now on the line is an author of a new book called The Last Punisher. He's also a SEAL Team 3 member, a sniper's true account of the Battle of Ramadi. We're not going to be able to talk a lot about that today, but I want to welcome Kevin. I'm going to mispronounce your name, Kevin. Kevin Lach?
Kevin Lace.
Lace. Okay, got it. Thank you for correcting me. Anyway, Kevin Lace is the author of The Last Punisher, and I asked him to be on our program about 9/11 because in reading your book, I found that you enlisted because of what occurred on 9/11.
I did, yeah. Thanks for having me on, guys. You know, it's crazy when you look back and we stand, you know, 15 years after the event, and, you know, how many lives were changed on that one day, and, you know, I, like many other veterans and still active duty members, you know, felt that call to action, you know, in the wake of 9/11, not knowing what's going on, but just being compelled to do something positive, you know, to help defend this country and, you know, and help rally around the cause. And, you know, we found in the wake of that that it doesn't matter where we go, whether it's Iraq, Afghanistan, there's evil throughout the world. And those of us that joined was in response to that.
I think it's very important for our audience to know, especially the civilian part, that, again, our military is entirely voluntary. There's no draft. Nobody forces anybody to join the military any longer. And not only did you join the military, but you went on to become a member of the Navy SEALs, which we know is kind of an elite organization, correct?
Yeah, it's more than kind of elite. You know, you're absolutely right. It's a volunteer force, and then you volunteer again to go into special operations. And, you know, where I was at in life, I wanted to get to the fight as soon as possible, and I went to the Marine office, and, you know, that didn't work out, but I found the Navy as that option, and, you know, took a lot of time training to get to that level and be at the levels of SEAL to get downrange. I felt that, you know, contribution-wise, that would, you know, fit myself correctly, and still there are no guarantees in a force that where there's an 85% attrition rate. You know, I just brought everything to the table and, you know, was lucky.
Lucky and determined and persistent and everything else to get through that training. And then you were deployed to the Battle of Ramadi, is that correct?
Correct, yes. We, at SEAL Team 3, we trained, we practiced, and we got ready to go to Baghdad, you know, to do a lot of direct action missions. But really where the fight was evolving in, you know, 2006, the height of sectarian violence, the civil war within Iraq, our assets were best utilized in Ramadi, where, you know, it was kind of a template for the pre-surge of 2007. So we worked with the 1st and the 502nd, you know, the Marines, to help secure that city with a, you know, clear hold build tactic.
Well, I think it's important for people to read your book about The Last Punisher, because that Battle of Ramadi, and we've had a number of people on the program that were there that particular time period. It's just house-to-house, hand-to-hand combat.
Yeah, and, you know, The Last Punisher isn't, you know, your typical SEAL book. We set out to not write a typical SEAL book. I wanted to disperse the credit, you know, left and right, rather than forward and directly back towards myself. Because it's the Battle of Ramadi, you know, and the success shared on that battlefield was a direct result of the teamwork and the collaboration of the Army, the Air Force, the Marines. And, you know, we were just a very small element to help, you know, in conjunction with everybody else to turn the tide of that battle.
Well, you certainly did that. And Kevin, really what I wanted to have you on the program in this short essay or this short segment was talk about what you have done since you got out of the service, because when you left the Navy, you've gone out on another mission.
Right. Yeah. You know, I got out of the Navy with a plan. I wanted to be a doctor prior to joining. That wasn't in the cards, but I worked a lot with physician assistants while I was in the Navy and saw what they were able to do and really, you know, felt that was the place for me. So I got out, went to the University of Connecticut, got my undergrad, and then went to Wake Forest. And from there, I'm a certified physician assistant here in Florida. And we have a private practice where we see a lot of special operations operators that come through and rehabilitate, a lot of like stress, a lot of metabolic issues because of the job, and get them back into the fight. And in addition to that, my wife and I started our charity Hunting for Healing, where we take spouses and veterans on hunting, fishing, and outdoor activities to enhance communication within the relationship.
I think that's a great program that you had. That was the last thing I was going to go to, was the Hunting for Healing, because there are so many of these programs, again, for our audience to find them. There are many of them around the country. I know in Michigan, I know of at least two people that take veterans hunting. I know that some that take disabled veterans fishing and hunting.
Yes, the fishing and the hunting is kind of the backdrop. It's really getting veterans and their spouses connected, and outside of their everyday life. And my wife and I launched it after our trip to Africa in 2015. And it's, I just got back from a gator hunting trip in Louisiana with a seventh group special forces gentleman and a couple, another SEAL and an AFSOC pilot. So, we're expanding. We have a couple things come up. We're going to Costa Rica on a billfish trip in March, and then we're taking two veterans and two spouses to Namibia, Africa, for a 7-day plains antelope hunt. So, we want to get involved in the community, create something special. And the hunting is special, but it's really the time with your spouse where they can enjoy and really find out what makes you tick and why you like to do these things.
There's a lot of organizations out there that are trying to help these veterans reconnect with their spouses, and there's Veterans and Caregivers Organization, because the spouses are the ones that were left at home and they never really knew exactly what was going on. And then you come home and sometimes you're not quite willing to tell everything that occurred, right?
Right, that is true. But I really think, while you're in the military and the teams, your friend group is quite extensive. Mm-hmm. You work and live, every day with the people that, care for your life overseas. And as you get out, and that's something I noticed, your friend group dwindles. Guys go their own way, and at the end of the day, it's you and your spouse, you and your swim buddy, and that communication, that bond needs to be the strongest if you're going to ensure success long term. And what we try and do is find that communication and show them, give them the opportunity to connect on a different level.
Well, where would people go to find out information about your Hunting for Healing?
Sure. You guys can go to www.huntingforhealing.org. We also have some links off of www.kevinlace.com. And we, like I said, the trip to Africa, we are going to be putting out live and taking video submissions for couples that would like to go on the excursion.
Okay. Thank you very much, Kevin Lace, author of The Last Punisher and also the founder of Hunting for Healing. Thank you very much for being on Veterans Radio. And, Kevin, I promised that we were going to get you on to talk more about this story. It's a fascinating story.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you. All right, Bob, well, we're done. We got 20 seconds.
20 seconds.
And she's over there starting to flip fingers at us all over the place as we're done. So
it was very nice doing a program with you.
It's always good. It's always good to do that. We want to thank our audiences for listening again today. That's Veterans Radio. We'll be back next week talking about suicide prevention. Suicide is not the answer. Dismissed.